Hi, and welcome to another episode of Django Chat. I'm Carlton Gibson. I'm joined as ever by Will Vincent.
Hi, Carlton.
And today we have a special guest, Jeff Triplett. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
When I thought of this podcast, one of the very first people I wanted to have honor do it with was you, Jeff. So I'm pleased that we're finally making this happen for episode 20 or whatever it is. So I was trying to think of how to describe your role in the Django community, but I thought I'd punt it to you because you do so many things. So if someone said, who are you and what do you do in Django, where would you start?
Probably that I don't say no, which I'm working on. So I've been a lot better at saying no for a while. But I am a Django and Python developer in Lawrence, Kansas, which is the home of Django. I do a lot for the community, but I am a PSF board of director. I'm the president of DEFNA, which is the nonprofit behind DjangoCon US. Also been the former chair. I'm kind of an advisor, organizer for the conference too now. I'm a Python fellow, which is not the same thing as Carlton's Django fellowship. I'm also a consultant and a partner at Revolution Systems in Lawrence, Kansas, which is what pays my bills. So,
all right. Do you say RevSys or Revolution Systems? How should we refer to it?
Revolution Systems is what everybody knows it as. We just kind of say RevSys, you know, shorthand. So it's kind of okay. Like DEFNA, the nonprofit I'm a part of is the Django Events Foundation of North America. It's just easier to say DEFNA. So RevSys is the same.
Okay, great. So given that you are a professional consultant, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is testing. So this is something that Carlton and I are asked frequently by by listeners. You know, I think as a consultant, you have sort of a unique view because you get to see a lot of different code bases, existing projects as well as new projects from scratch, whereas most people are kind of working on the same code base for years at a time. And so they don't necessarily have a chance to think about how they do tests. So I'm curious if maybe the three of us can just talk about testing, and I don't know where we start, if it's on a new project or an existing one. Maybe we'll start with an existing one because we've had that conversation where...
Yeah, I mean, one thing I'm really interested in when you get a client and you get a new project and then you're like, we've got a... Perhaps Sites hasn't got tests, right? Let's start there. That's the archetypal one. What do you do if you get a...
So Carlton comes to you and says, here's my project, but I've got no tests. What do you do?
Well, that's... not uncommon, but it's also not super common. So usually we're kind of somewhere in the middle. And especially like as a consultant, you have a problem and you're coming to us either because you want to build something or, you know, you've got fires every time you deploy code. So starting from no tests, the first thing I want to do is basically lay down a simple layer of tests. And so I want it to be effective because I do not like writing tests. I don't know that many people who really like writing tests. One of my coworkers, Lacey Williams Henschel, she loves writing tests for some reason. And so you open up a test file, you can see thousands of lines of code. Not what I do, but what I will do is I think the most effective way to start is to look at your views in Django. If you're doing Django REST framework stuff, you can also do endpoints, which is also a view in Django. So I'll start there. And what I'll try to do is just a really thin layer of test everything that's a view, record the status codes and just see what they are. And so you'll get a lot of 200 status codes, which are going to tell you that everything is working in some way. It may not be working 100%, but at least Django is telling you things are fine. Then I'll go through and I'll still record like 400 and 500 error tests or status codes, which is going to tell you that maybe there's a piece of data missing to be able to see that view and to have all the information come up. And so once we kind of very quickly go through and just get some kind of test coverage, and then that way, at least we have a test suite. So if I go in and delete a bunch of code or I make changes, it'll at least tell me if the status codes are going to be the same. And then once we have that reassurance, then we'll go back and start looking at, you know, why is there a 400 error on this or a 404 in this particular view? That may be that like I'm trying to hit a blog article or something and it just doesn't exist. So then that gives me room to be able then to do like generate some data or use a factory library, which will, you know, create fake data. And then I can start testing against that to see, you know, does this view work as expected? After that, then we'll hit the 500 level code or 500, status codes and start making sure that, you know, we have the parts of the view that need to be there for the application to not blow up. So if it's a blog or something, there might be categories, there might be tags, there might be authors. There might be some other bits of information there that's needed just to construct that view and to make it testable. Once this is done, Another pass I like to go back and do is Django has a really nice feature called assert num queries inside the test framework. And so we'll use that then to start like measuring how many database calls each view has. And this is usually what's pretty critical. Like if you called me because your homepage is slow, when I start looking at how many database queries are on it, you may have 200 database queries or you might have 2000. So that's kind of a good place to start. And if like every view starts to have like a ton of database queries, that may mean that you have like a part of middleware that runs a number of requests that's going to be hitting the database more than it should. And so, and this, once you kind of have this base level of test to know the status codes are good, you know where the database queries are, then we can start making performance decisions. So we've had a lot of like nightmare stories where we had a middleware one time where a client was hitting their database and pulling up and trying to do it. I think this was like the earlier prefetch related days or something. I think it's prefetch related.
Because prefetch, so, select related was there first and then prefetch was added, I think, right?
Correct. So basically prefetch would load up everything associated with a table. So it might do like an early lookup. And so this was a case where somebody had, let's say, 250,000 categories. And so every single request made to any page on their website was reloading this table. And they weren't caching it either.
Yeah, I was going to say, just cache it, no problem. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you cache it, it wouldn't have been bad. It still would be bad because that's a lot of data that they have access on every request.
It's a first step, yeah.
So I think this has been fixed in Django now. So you can actually like limit the number of records that are going to be accessed. So that was like a pretty glaring, like that was an easy one. Like, let's just eliminate this one middleware, cache this one request or this access so that it only gets hit one time. And let's limit actually how much data it's pulling in. And then your website's going to be a whole lot more performant than it was before. But without tests, without looking at database queries, there's no way you would ever know that that's actually what the problem was.
Yeah, that's super. Yeah, and that's a really good example.
I assume that to see like the number of database queries, almost everyone's using Django Debug Toolbar. Is that what you would use?
I actually never use it. I think it's a great tool. I just go straight to the test on that because it's going to tell me more. And, you know, most of the time I'm dealing with backend code. So if I'm working on APIs, it doesn't really buy me much. And again, I think it's a great tool. It's just, where do you spend your time? And for me, most of it is just running tests.
Yeah.
So there's actually sites that I've developed features for and APIs that I have probably maybe looked at the actual front end at it maybe once or twice.
Yeah, I use Debug Toolbar a lot for the templates because what it'll do is show you the exact templates that were rendered, the includes that came in, the context that was available in each one. It's like, yeah, that's quite handy, but that's a template layer rather than what Jeff's talking about.
Yeah, and where does logging fit into all of that? Or does it?
It depends on what type of logging, really, because that's gotten so... I mean, so for some people, logging is just printing, you know, to the console. We've dealt with some pretty big systems where, you know, we're basically spitting out JSON via Django struct log, and that's getting consumed by like another process. So especially like in the Docker world, like we're collecting the logs sometimes and aggregating it to like another system where we can go in and check and see what's going on. So we can leave clues about metrics of this user logged in or this user did something else. So it kind of depends on what you mean by logging. Like,
fair enough. Yeah. what about if you have a greenfield project? How does RevSys think about testing in that capacity? Do you have an internal framework that you use on new projects, or what's different versus an existing project that you get?
From the beginning, then we don't really have an excuse to not have good test coverage. So, you know, and again, like I tend to start with views. And part of it really depends on what the client's, what's their business objective. Like right now we're working with a client that's a friend of mine, and it's basically like a brew pub type service where you can walk into a restaurant, you can order food, they can bring it right out to you, and you can do everything through your phone, which is kind of nice. Because if the restaurant's busy, you don't have to worry about waiting. If, five of you sit down and a sixth and seventh person sit down after you've already made your order, then they can come back and bring you food or drinks or whatever.
Yeah, so, this is super common in Asia in particular. I think this is like the norm. Plus, not so much in the U.S. yet.
Yeah, so for that test, you know, or for that situation, we're starting with REST. Basically, we've done all the modeling. We'll write a little bit of model test for it. But we're basically looking at what's the business logic. You know, is the business logic or is the main core part of the application going to be inventories, or is it going to be the ordering systems? And then we try to prioritize, like, what is the bread and butter of the application that has to work perfectly? And then that's what we're going to make sure that we have 100% test coverage on. And so from there, we just kind of distill it down. If you have about pages, you probably don't need anything more than just a simple test to know that this thing doesn't blow up. And like I was talking about database queries earlier, we just want to make sure that somebody doesn't add a template tag to pull in news articles or something, and you end up not getting a select related on, and all of a sudden you've got a couple of thousand database hits on your homepage, because that's really frequent.
Yeah, it's worth testing the 200. Does this template actually render? You know, somebody mistypes a template, they use a template tag that's just, you know, that you never loaded the page, you didn't check it was running, but if you've got a unit test that just loads it and check that it returns something sensible, that error will be picked up.
Yeah, for sure. So I definitely tend to like err more towards performance when it comes to testing.
Business logic. This is something Carlton and I have talked a lot about and always like to ask guests. How do you think about where to put that? Because in Django, you can put it in the views, but you can also, and if you can, you can put it in the managers or in the models. I'm wondering what sort of, how do you think about, you know, that question of where to put the logic? And obviously that can change over the project as you build things out. But do you subscribe to the fat models, slim views approach, or?
I really don't like either one. I mean, it kind of depends. And part of being a consultant is people are very opinionated. So some people will have thousands of lines of business logic inside of models. And it's hard to follow. And so I usually like a mix of in between. With views, especially with endpoints and stuff for doing like REST APIs, if you put too much of the business logic in like a traditional Django view, then you're going to lose that whenever you're using like Django REST framework. And so I tend to try to do as little as possible with a web request. So sometimes that means we're taking the actual logic and maybe putting it in Celery. So I had an application I worked on a couple of years ago where they would literally get millions of hits, sometimes during really active like news and stuff like that. And so people might come and do a bunch of donations. And so what we would do is batch order those requests up, and we'd put them in Celery to be processed, because we don't want like any blocking to go on when you hit a form or when you hit an endpoint. We want to try to get the request, you know, we want to try to get a response back to the user as quickly as possible. So in that case, we want the view to not really do much, but do a quick validation check, get their information, batch things up, put it inside a Celery, make the actual request go through, and then we can like email them later to give them the, you know, to congratulate or thank them or whatever. So it really just kind of depends on the application. I know signals aren't really popular. I tend to not want to put a lot in signals, but I do tend to use signals as an easy way to hook into parts of an application to call Celery. And that's a pattern that I'm pretty comfortable and happy to use.
And then PyTest, that's funny, actually. Do you want to plug your you guys site?
Yeah, so this is one of those things that just kind of, it's, I guess, passive-aggressively annoys me. But Lacey Williams Henschel, we are co-workers, and we worked on DjangoCon together for 4 or 5 years. And one thing that we get a lot of, especially being in business meetings now that we work together, is, you know, there might be 4 or 5 guys in a room, and then there will be, you know, one woman, and then someone will repeatedly use the term guys over and over and over again. And it's kind of one of those, once you hear it, you can't unhear it type of, you know, statements or phrases. And it's really common. And so a lot of people will say, like, it's okay to use guys because it's gender neutral. Well, you know, if I were to just use hey girls or hey gals in a room full of men, people would notice. And, you know, there's better ways to speak. And so it's an easy way to make people feel more inclusive and not make people feel exclusive. So we wrote a site, and I'm gonna have to look it up. I think it's heyguys.cc.
Yeah, we'll put it in the show notes.
And it's just kind of a quick, easy way to send to people and let them know, like, you know, I use it as like an email footer. And so it just kind of reinforces it. So once we've started using like y'all, I've had clients thank us after the fact, and we don't correct them. It's like, I'm not going to stop you in a meeting and say it. It's just kind of through osmosis of the more that we can say this, the more that, you know, people will pick up on it after a while.
It's just about changing cognitive biases, right? It's not necessarily that there's a conscious prejudice, but there's this kind of cognitive bias and this kind of paternalistic language that we use. And if we just think about it, we can start to change it. And perhaps we change the attitudes that created it. And
yeah, maybe I made that statement on purpose. Yeah.
Oh, well done.
But I was going to ask y'all, do you use PyTest for your tests?
Yes.
Maybe you could talk about why. Because I don't think everyone does. What do you like about PyTest? Because it's another thing to add in, but you know, basically once you've learned it, it has a number of shortcuts is sort of the selling points of it.
Yeah, I think it's faster is probably why I started using it. And it does have a lot of really neat plugins. And so I don't know that I have like a bunch of go-tos that I can mention off the top of my head, but there's some like different formatting. It kind of has the right hooks involved so I can like pop into a stack trace at the right places, which is really helpful if a test is failing, because I don't want to run a test suite that's going to take a while. And, you know, if I have to wait 5 minutes, which your test suite shouldn't have to wait that long anyways, but I want to be able to like be able to debug and look at the code through tests to try to figure out, you know, what's going on. And PyTest just seems to work well. It's a pretty good standard. You can basically just install it and run it. In most Django apps I've used, I really haven't even had to do much to actually just be able to, you know, install it and run and it just go. So actually, I think in a couple dozen projects, I've never actually had to change any code to work with it. RefSys does have an open source project called Django Test Plus, and it kind of adds some nice wrappers around the Django test suite. And I believe the last couple of versions actually has some better PyTest support for it too, because PyTest tends to like this very like functional view type where you can make easy test functions and you don't have to have like a class and stuff. And Django Test Plus actually, well, PyTest kind of has some nice wrappers around not needing like a, what would you say, like a class-based test approach. And so I tend to, since I learned a class-based test approach, that's what I tend to do with Django, just because, I don't know, I've got a pattern that I like, but I do plan to spend some more time writing a PyTest native looking tests.
I'm sort of in halfway land in between. I kind of used PyTest as a runner, and I love plain asserts, you know, just being able to use the plain Python assert statement instead of self, what was it, assert equal, what was the parameters for that? That, you know, that kind of remembering what the assert statements are. But I still like the unit test style classes because they help me group tests. And perhaps that's just because I'm not quite into the PyTest idiom yet. But, you know, that's kind of where I'm at with it.
Yeah, I find that tests, because I'm asked a lot by people learning Django to cover testing. And I think it's a somewhat hard thing to teach because you rarely see it in any sort of linear fashion. You'll see, you know, maybe an open source thing just has a bazillion tests and it's hard to make sense of it. Yet most people, if they just throw something up, maybe won't have tests. So tests are, I think of them as they're really confusing until you learn kind of the standard tests that you write every time. Kind of you were mentioning you have your standard views tests, and then they get really boring because you're just kind of tossing them at everything. So that's sort of the leap, is like you want to get to the point where you go, oh, okay, I can just, you know, kind of copy these tests that I've written elsewhere to this project. But until you get to that point, it is this feeling of, well, I don't even know how to get this page to work, and now I'm supposed to write tests, and oh, I'm supposed to do test-driven development and write the test first. It's like, well, I don't know where I'm trying to go. That's kind of the mindset I see of beginners. And so maybe with that said, I take it you don't do a pure test-driven approach, or how do you think about that?
I don't. I feel like kind of my job, especially with like a greenfield project, is I want to model the project and I want to see the data first. And so I kind of do a Django admin first approach. So I'll write the models and then I pop them in Django admin, because I feel like everything else in Django kind of derives from that pattern.
Agreed.
So when I start doing Django REST framework, even a lot of the filter options, a lot of the way the data fits together, the admin for me kind of models that very well. And so once I can see it and visualize it, and it's pretty easy for me sometimes to discuss with other developers like how to make model changes that maybe they're struggling with, just because I will go into the admin, I'll create the models and I'll interact with it. And so it's easier to see like a mini to mini in this situation may not be the best, you know, the best way to model something, especially when you start getting into like Django REST framework, because dealing with mini to minis, especially when you're doing like nested serializers, so you've got, you know, multiple layers of models deep, or, you know, model references in JSON, it's hard to work with. And it's really, you know, you've got these really cool rapid design tools with Django and Django REST framework, and as soon as you start getting into nested serializers, it just all kind of falls down and you're doing everything by hand. So Carlton, you work on Django REST framework, don't you?
Yeah, Carlton,
I do.
What do you think about that?
I've just been busy nodding away to everything you say, Jeff.
Can you fix that?
No. And I'll tell you why. Because there's a limit to what's auto-introspectable within, you know, reasonable effort. Unless, you know, you have to be I'm fairly sure that for some specific framework in a specific setup, you can create some code which will introspect much better than what's available in Django REST framework. But that will only apply to that particular project, right? And particularly with nested serializers, like there are different conventions. Are they meant to be read-only? Are they meant to be writable? If they are writable, how do you handle conflicts? Do you abort the whole request? Do you write the ones which don't conflict and then report the errors on the one that do? How does that look? What's the format of those serializers? Those are decisions that a framework like Django REST framework can't make for you. Not yet, not in this stage in the where the technology frontier is. Yeah, what else can I say? I'm nodded everything you said. Yeah, it does get complex, especially, you know, if you've got a many-to-many with a through model and you want to serialize some attributes from the through model on the nested serial. You've just got to make those decisions. And yes, I think ultimately you have to write serializers by hand. But
well, speaking of complexity, another thing I wanted to ask you about is, what are your feelings on Docker in terms of, do you use it all the time on projects? Do you try to convince clients of that they should switch to it if they're not? Where do you fall on that spectrum? And I say this, you've actually taught me a lot about Docker over the last few months, so I know you know how to use it, but I'm curious what your preferences are.
I like it a lot, actually. I think it's overused, and sometimes people, you know, they see Docker as a hammer and they just try to use Docker to solve everything. Jesse Frizzell, who I'm a huge fan of, she's written some really amazing Go code, and I think she's written pretty much everything. Like, I've seen discussions before spiral online where people are saying this part of Kube is broken, and she's like, no, I fixed it. And there's like, well, this is a bug, and this is something that's a bug in Docker. And she'll point to literally her commits in like Kube or Docker, or they'll then complain that this is a problem in a particular like Linux library, and she'll point to the code that she fixed also in Linux. And it's just amazing to see people like that who, you know, who have worked on and can work on Go code and everything.
Didn't she just have a tweet?
I think I just wanted to plug her because she's awesome. So,
and didn't she just have a tweet a couple days ago that said maybe containers were a mistake? I saw that.
It's probably because of that overuse. And I think why I was thinking of Jesse is because she has this awesome GitHub repo of Docker files. And so she runs Chrome and Docker on her laptop. And so everything she runs is Docker based, which is amazing.
Wow.
I like Docker. My clients are kind of mixed on it, but what we can do with containerization is just absolutely amazing. And I don't mean me as like a consultant. I just mean technology-wise. Like when I compile a Docker container, when I make an image, I know that that's kind of a contract that it's going to run if I give it the right environment variables and link it to the right, you know, context. So like if I know this thing needs Postgres and it needs Redis, as long as I plug the right values in and tell it where to go, it's going to run. And I've already tested it, so I know how it's going to perform. When you start using like some of the container services, and I don't want to plug any particular one because they're all great and crap at the same time, but it's really powerful to say, like, I can start this running on one node, and if I need 100 of them, I can spin that up in a couple of minutes. And that's amazing.
Right. And you can also, it's more, you can take it from one provider to another much more easily because it is just containers.
It's also a lot easier, I think, working with other developers because it's no longer, oh, well, you know, use Homebrew, but you're on Windows or you're on Linux, so you need to figure something else out. Like once I have a Docker Compose set up and I run tests on it, I know as long as you have Docker installed on your machine, it's going to run. And that can also run on like GitHub or GitLab, I guess GitLab, since GitHub doesn't have a test runner thing yet. But, you know, I can use CI tools to reliably run and test it. And so that to me is pretty great.
Yeah. I mean, I'm almost tempted with true beginners who are struggling who want to do Django to install Python to say, well, let's just jump to Docker. But, you know, I can give them a recipe that works, but then I think it's a little much for them. But it does, you know, fundamentally, it is the answer, which is a reproducible environment that all team members can have. And you can almost entirely mimic production locally, too, which is pretty nice to do.
Yeah, it definitely can be. But like, let's say you take a beginner, how are you going to tell them to deploy Django to DigitalOcean, let's say?
Like, is
that
easier?
So you tell them to use Heroku, or what's the answer?
So now you're punting to me. So let me just say that I hate deployment.
Everybody does. That's
I think the issue is that most people, they don't have to deal with deployment. They're in a company or in an environment where someone else has figured it out, or you iterate on it and you just kind of like hold your breath and get through it. And then it works. It's a pain. I mean, I tell people, I usually recommend Heroku or Python Anywhere just because they're pretty straightforward and they have free tiers. Actually with Heroku, so in my book, which should be out by the time this is released, Django for Professionals, I'm finishing up the deployments chapter. And a big question I had is, we use Docker in the book. Do we deploy with Docker as well? Because Heroku just added this pretty recently. And I think it's simpler when I show you exactly how to do it. But I don't know exactly if it's simpler than, I think it is, than doing it the old proc file way. But there's just a lot of, for Heroku, I mean, Heroku in particular, there's just a lot of steps, right? I mean, it'd be nice if, you know, Carlton or someone had a perfect drag and drop deployment for Django, but, you know, collect static, you got to configure static files. It's just a lot of things. It's hard to go from a basic CRUD app to a deployable worthy project without taking a whole ton of shortcuts, allowed hosts, you know, deployment checklist. So that's a that's a rambling way of saying I haven't fully figured out exactly how to handle it, other than I know the two extremes. And as I become more comfortable with Django, I'm less comfortable just sort of waving my hands at stuff and not covering it for people. But I am still a big believer in an iterative learning path. And so I don't want to overwhelm folks with proper deployment. So
it's tricky because
I'm not sure.
There is no really simple solution. I'm still a big fan of, you know, run a VM. And if you want to use Docker, just use Docker on the VM. And if you need to scale it, get a bigger VM for, you know, to keep a lot of these things simpler. But that only goes so far. And eventually you do need, you know, 100 units, and then you need, you know, Kubernetes or whatever, because, you know, VMs aren't going to go that far.
Yeah. I don't know. What do you think? I mean, we actually just had a whole episode on deployments where I think we gave some of our thoughts. I mean, basically the advice is pick something, learn it, and then move on. And if you have to focus on it, that's a great problem to have, and then you can take other steps.
Well, I think the selling point for me is, if you ever try to like set up a, let's say, a Django app, and not to pick on Django, any Python app or really almost anything, it is a pain. When you say, like, PHP kind of has an advantage because you can, in theory, copy PHP code and run it remotely on services that run PHP. But if you try to host your own, because if you have a website that needs to scale at all, you're not going to use that model. And so you're going to go and you're going to have to install, I don't even know now, Apache. You're going to install a bunch of libraries and a bunch of stuff. And the average person's not going to be able to do it. And so one thing that I like, and I think you could actually do this kind of tutorial, if you go and fire up a DigitalOcean, and DigitalOcean needs to sponsor you now. I think we plugged them like four or five times. But if you go to DigitalOcean, if you install Docker, you can actually run your base image on port 80, and you don't have to install really anything else. And so that to me is pretty powerful, to just apt-get install Docker, run your image container. You've got to do some authentication stuff that you'd have to do anyways, even if you're doing a Git checkout. And so one thing I've liked is through like GitLab or through Docker's registry, you can push images from your local machine to that.
Yeah.
You can run another Docker process. I use one called Watchtower, and all it does is it looks for new images, it pulls it, and it restarts the service that's running. That's about the most simplistic architecture I can think of for how to run something if you're rolling it your own. Now, that's built upon years of knowing, like, here's how these applications and these parts put together. And that's really the challenge. It's not that this stuff is so technical you can't teach somebody. It's also that, you know, I kind of did all the crappy parts with Linux for a long time, and I don't want to do that. But I also want to know what's running behind the box, because I don't know that I want to hand a container to, you know, a cloud provider and trust what's going on behind the scenes, or even know, like, if I'm paying X amount of dollars, why do I get one Docker process, or how many Docker processes do I get? And I think that it's been kind of hard for cloud providers to be able to explain and sell that to people in a way they understand it. Heroku's probably done the best job of that.
What's also difficult is the costs. You know, it's really hard to see how things scale, and short of like putting them on there and trusting it and then finding you've got a big bill. It's, you know, which you often read, you know, I got $17,000 on Firebase or whatever. It's like, you know, how do you control that?
I would say that is true, but like, that is the problem you want to have. You want to have such crazy traffic that you have a huge bill, and then it's worth the time to dive in and solve it. And I would add, I mean, this comes from, even at scale, you know, if you can throw hardware at a problem, any problem you can throw money at, I think that's a good problem to have. I mean, you know, in a startup setting, like, yeah, okay, you need to find the money, but it's so much easier to throw money than some of these trickier problems. So if it's, oh, we just need more machines, okay, like that's a good problem, right? Like, you're always going to have problems. So yeah, you don't want a $70,000 Firebase bill, but you kind of got to blame yourself if somehow you rack that up, right? I mean, were you just sitting there and you didn't see the analytics, you didn't see the millions of traffic?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You know, I never.
And again, I would take that problem, because either you just, I don't know, either your company goes out of business because you don't know what you're doing anyways, or you're growing so fast you can find the money somehow. Like, it's solvable.
That's, yeah, you know, like going bankrupt is a good fix for a success.
Yeah, but I mean, on deployment separately, I don't know. You know, for any of these providers that are listening, I mean, I was just going through the Heroku docs yesterday, and I've done Heroku so many times, and I was finding the container part confusing. Like, I would love to have a simple Django project and just show how to, in I guess my words, deploy it on all these major services. But the challenge is that they don't have affiliate fees, so it's just totally giving it away. It takes a lot of time, and they change all the time.
Yeah, they change them all. That's what's so difficult.
So it's just not worth it. But yeah, if anyone wants to
sponsor Will to show how to deploy on your
sponsor
platform.
Me, I would love to do that. But anyway, separate. Moving on.
Right. So I want to talk about your community work, Jeff. I want to talk about the work you've done.
Oh, we're gonna jump right to that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Come on, we've got Docker's.
I want to talk about architecting a little bit more.
Okay, go on then. Yeah, more on architect.
Okay, I've seen you talk about, Jeff, how you're able to evaluate the time a project will take, and I would just love any sort of stories you can tell about the mismatch between what clients think and kind of what you see, and how you have that conversation where someone comes to you with some outrageous request. How do you kind of talk them down from that cliff? And, you know, what words do you use when they think something will happen, you know, can be done in a month, and you know it takes 12 months, right? Because that's got to happen all the time.
It doesn't, strangely enough.
Okay.
And I know I started the podcast saying I don't.
My other consultant friends have that all the time, so you're different.
Well, I mean, it just is what it is. I mean, so let's say a client comes to us and they say, we want this really awesome service, and it's something that, you know, has taken years to build. So let's say somebody comes to us and they want GitHub or something. We could say, sure, that's multi millions of dollars to do. And, you know, we're a small company, so we don't have the, you know, like the labor or the workers to do this thing. But you can't just come in and say, copy every feature of a multi-million dollar or billion-dollar startup realistically and put it up in 2 weeks. Like, it's just not going to happen. So it really depends on, can we just evaluate, is this even doable? Part of it is, if you come to us with a bad business model, and Frank does more of this than I do, so I can make it sound like a better story, but we do discuss it as well. If you come with us to a really bad business model, and we know that you're not going to be able to be successful at it, or it's just a bad idea, then we want to also get paid. And so if we can't get paid to do the work because of your bad business, then there's no reason for us to do it. We don't want to be in the collections business. We want to be in the write applications and, you know, do what we do. So for me, it's realistically a, you have a feature or you have an MVP. So the site that we just finished, that's been, or we, it's going through like a beta process and stuff where we're doing the brew pubs. They had a 3-month deadline basically, and they knew they have investors and these are the marks they need to hit. So if they say, we need to be able to sit down at a restaurant at 6 p.m. on a Monday, which is what they did, and order a couple of beers or a cheeseburger, that's what we know that the goal is. So if we need to scrap other features because the inventory management maybe doesn't matter as much because the order has to go through. So for us, it's really a matter of prioritizing, these are the features. And when people come to us and say, we want to add this other thing, or an investor or somebody thinks it'd be really cool if we could do XYZ, it's just reminding them of the focus. And that is, you know, this is the idea you have sold. This is what you need to do. We can do these things, but the more things that you add, the more that deadline's going to get pushed back. And so I can do that, I guess, without sounding like, I don't know, I guess I'm being a consultant as long as I have, I can tell people no, and they thank me for it. Where when I was probably 8 or 10 years ago, they probably didn't thank me. They thought I was being rude, or maybe I didn't know how to communicate it. So
maybe 8 or 10 years ago, you might not have had the authority that you have now. So that you I don't know, I'm just sort of extrapolating from my own experience, where you find yourself in scenarios where unrealistic deadline after unrealistic deadline after unrealistic deadline, and you're saying, look, this can't be done and here's why, but it's not, that's not necessarily being listened to. And you know, software estimation is notoriously difficult and managers notoriously don't listen. So do you think that I'm thinking specifically about this software estimation problem and like working with clients. I guess the point I started from was when you said 8 or 10 years of, you know, 8 or 10 years ago, did you find you were able to make that point, or were you just, did you find yourself in a not listened to then?
Yes. So 8 or 10 years ago, I was at the Lawrence Journal World, and I was working for one of their startups that was, I worked on Ellington CMS, which was the first Django app, or actually I think it was technically the second Django app, but it's the biggest at the time. And so we rolled this thing out to hundreds and hundreds of newspapers. And so I got used to unrealistic deadlines. I got used to trying to do all-nighters, not because they pushed us to do this thing, but it just was like self-induced pressure to do it. And then at some point, I just decided, I'm not doing that. I'm not going to stay super late. I'm not going to do all-nighters. I can tell you what I can do realistically, because I just don't want to do it. Like, life is too short. So if a client wants to fire me for not, which never happens, because I won't work the weekend for them, then it's not a good fit. And it takes a lot of privilege to be in that situation to be able to say that. But clients tend to respect us more for that, because they don't want to be stressed out because we're working on a feature an hour before they're supposed to show it, especially if like their income is based on this demo being successful. Most of the time, when we deal with startups, that's a little more normal, that, you know, they're kind of going from like funding round to funding round. That's probably not most of what we do, but you know, I think it's kind of a trust too, that can we deliver it? When we say we're going to deliver something, we're going to do it. We're going to deliver. And it's just a matter of what features do we need to cut out. I think with working on the projects like you do, you probably understand, is it better to do the feature wrong or not 100%? Or is it better just to land the feature just to say you did it?
Well, with something like Django, it's better to just take the time it needs. It's got to be a good feature. There's no point putting in a broken feature. So if it takes, you know, longer to get in, that's fine, because Django is an upstream dependency of all these, you know, end projects. But in a commercial environment, sometimes it's like, no, this feature's got to ship on this date, and because the marketing department sold it to the client before the estimation was ever done. You know, it strikes me as that happens all the time in software. I mean, it's, you know, it's not great, obviously.
I mean, I think it's just because we're not afraid, or I'm not afraid to just cut out features or cut out what we need to get it done. Yeah. But it's going to change based on their feedback and what else they need. So, but we're pretty upfront about it. So kind of if we take a project on and we know it's going to be 3 months, can we deliver this in 3 months? And, you know, we can whittle that back. And I don't know. I don't sit down with any like task tools to measure productivity or try to figure out how to do it. When I look at models and kind of know, can I get this MVP up in a couple of weeks? And if I can get the models done, the rest, you know, the DRF stuff, it's just the tools that we deal with are so mature now that it's pretty easy to kind of guesstimate, I guess, in my mind, what it's going to take to get something at least, you know, plausible and passable.
Yeah, and that's the key point about estimation, right? Is that it's always... There's this idea, this meme, this trope that software timelines aren't estimatable. But with mature technology you've done it a lot of times, then yeah, they kind of really are, because you know, oh, it'll take a day or so to put these views wrapped around this. It's exactly that. Can you model it right? And if you've got the models and that business layer, the views are a known commodity.
And you know what? DRF makes it so easy to, like, there's a pattern that I've kind of grown into recently that I like, where we'll do a lot of model view sets. And I'll basically take all of the models and make an admin version of it. And that's going to require like a staff or super user or something. And that's easy and quick for us to do. If you're a front end person, that's not the most useful thing. If you're writing like an admin or something for it, like a JavaScript based admin, then, you know, it may be a pain, but technically the job is done and you can hit everything. And then from there, that's where we go back to that, like, what's the bread and butter of your application? And we'll start writing like very particular views so you can place an order, or so you can get like a full menu with all the nested everything that you want. And then that way we can work on optimizing those views. But by default, I do push back on front end people sometimes to say, this isn't a very performant way of doing things. So if you just want to save an extra request, don't. I'll make it easy so you can do batch requests, which I would love to see in DRF, by the way.
Well,
there's a bunch of things we can do to make lives easier too that aren't always nested.
Okay, you know? So the thing I'm really hoping for with the whole async thing, the ASCII and whatnot, is that we can have a way of really building simple kind of proxy endpoints which hit, you know, because the natural format of a REST API is flat, right? So you have one request for ingredients, one for drinks, one for, you know, whatever. But the request that front-end developers want to make is one request fetching, you know, all of these and all of those and all of those and combining them. I'm really hopeful that the async stuff will enable us to build quick proxy endpoints that will really serve front-end developers really well. So I don't know if that's going to come in DRF per se, but it'll be part of the Django async move, I think. That's what I'm hoping.
Oh, I think that'd be great. As somebody who does a little bit with DjangoCon, I think we have a few fun surprises coming up. So,
all right. So speaking of DjangoCons and community, let's dive into that area. And maybe we could start with, so when we met at PyCon, you mentioned you were off to the Python board meeting. What's the titles for that? And then we'll get to the Django specific stuff. So you're involved with, you're sort of like the Django representative on Python right now?
I wouldn't say that, because Katie McLaughlin and if I said her name correctly, there's other Django people on the Python Software Foundation board. And so a year ago at PyCon, a couple of people came to me that were directors and they said they were going to be stepping down and asked me to run. And so I thought, sure, why not? I really didn't think I would get on the board. And then I think I was on a flight from Chicago coming home and my phone blew up when I landed and apparently I'm on the board. So,
so what
I don't think
entail?
They knew what they were getting and I don't think I knew what I was getting into. So it's been good. It's basically a lot of meetings, a lot of email. The Python Software Foundation is the nonprofit behind the Python language. And so what they try to focus on is the education and the community and growing the community. So like if you have events, you can hit the PSF up for money to try to help and spread the word about Python. I'm still new enough to it that I don't kind of have the spiel down. So I'm still trying to learn it all. So hopefully none of them listen and then cringe whenever they.
Well, Katie, we already interviewed her and her interview will be coming out before yours. So that's at least one other.
Awesome.
Well, so education, community events, are there discussions about the language itself and features, or is that handled by a separate part of the organization for Python?
So I know that's changed recently and there's a governance board. So they used to have a BDFL model, which doesn't really scale. Like one person just doesn't scale. And so I don't know the timeline, but that recently has changed into a council, which I guess they discussed at PyCon. So the board itself has nothing to do with the actual language as far as features and stuff goes. When they're going to have meetups or they want to try to like get all the CPython devs together to work on stuff, I think they do it like once or twice a year. Yeah, so anything we can do to aid CPython for their meetups or their, I guess it's like an in-person meeting they'll do a couple times a year, or at least once a year. If we can help fund that to try to get everybody together, because not everybody works for a big corporation and can afford to go, then really anything we can do to support the community and support that movement is good for Python. And that's good for Django and good for all the projects we like to work on.
Yeah. Well, and so just as Python has the Python Software Foundation, Django has the Django Software Foundation, which you are, I know you're a part of it. Do you have a specific title as well within that these days?
I'm just I don't even know what I am. I think I'm just a contributing member. I don't know. Carlton, do you know what that's called?
DSF member. I don't know if there's categories of that. There's the DSF. Anyone can join the DSF, by the way. If you're a Django user, part of Django community, go to the DjangoProject.com website, look for the Django Software Foundation. There's a form you can fill in and you can apply to join this. It's not like there's an entry criteria other than, you know, just that you're a real person, I guess. But join the DSF. There's a mailing list for that, which, you know, it's private in that only DSF members are on it, but it's not private in the sense that you can't be on it. And that's about the Django community. And, you know, it's not particularly high traffic, so do join. But I don't think there's...
Well, then there's Defna too.
Yeah, Defna's right? Something so... else. Because Defna's responsible for organizing DjangoCon, am I right in that?
And I know you've done, maybe if you want to thump your chest a little bit about your involvement with DjangoCons, because I know you've done a lot.
Yeah, so I guess I've been a principal organizer for, I think this is the sixth year, something like that. Yeah, I didn't even know where to start with.
How did you get involved? I guess you've been working with Django forever. So how did the ball of organizing DjangoCon land in your hands?
I went to the first DjangoCon because I was working at Lawrence Journal World. And I've kind of been to most of them. I've probably been to half or 75% of them. After like everything starting off as a community model, a couple of things didn't work, I guess, out very well. And so it kind of became a commercial model, which worked for a while, and then that didn't work out. So I just happened to go to one where things really weren't working out at all. And so I just kind of volunteered to try to like make sure that, you know, there were speakers and there was stuff going on. So I guess you could say I was the last minute program chair with about a week or 2 weeks notice. And so I don't mind begging and asking people for help. So I asked a couple of people if they would speak. I think Russ spoke like 3 or 4 times at the conference. So thank you, Russ. That was amazing. And then we basically made sure that DjangoCon happened. Russell Keith McGee at the time was the DSF president. He asked me if I'd be interested in maybe, you know, trying to at least get the next DjangoCon going, even if I wasn't going to be involved with it. One of the speakers who stepped up and really helped a lot was Craig Bruce. And so he said, if you're in, I'm in, we could maybe create a nonprofit and start this. Stacy Haisler, who was at the time, I think the DSF maybe treasurer, she volunteered as well. And so the three of us started the Django Events Foundation of North America. And our goal was just to make sure that DjangoCon US happened. And then after that, things kind of were going a little better. The community got really behind it and was really, you know, helping us grow and do good stuff. And so, you know, when we were just basically trying to have a conference that, you know, evened out every year or hopefully didn't lose a bunch of money, we started taking the extra profits, putting some of that back into the DSF, putting those back into other Django events and Python events that we feel, you know, support the community. And so that's kind of how that ball got rolling.
Right. And so, and one thing that's sort of really noticeable about the Django community is the, for want of a better word, outreach, you know, to make sure that the speakers are representative and that, you know, everybody can attend, or, you know, that it's not just white men in a room, for want of a better phrase. So how did that get going, or, you know, what's the birth of that and that kind of important stuff? Because for me, it's one of the features of the Django community that makes it worth hanging around for.
So the first DjangoCon US was in Santa Clara. And there were a couple of women who worked at Lawrence Journal World, at least one woman worked at Lawrence Journal World. And then a couple of the more notable people who were women in the Django community were there. And it was really odd for me walking in and knowing 4 or 5 of maybe 10 women of 200 people. And so it was just a weird experience. It was mostly white men. And so from there, when I looked at, let's say, DjangoCon, when some of the years were going pretty well, representation wasn't very good. Like, we probably the first, and I'll just throw out a number, maybe the first 9 or 10 years of DjangoCon, I don't know that we had a single woman speak as a keynote speaker. And so looking at that, whenever I was the program chair and started doing like my first actual all running DjangoCon, I wanted to make sure that we prioritize having a couple of women speak. And so I think by the time I had my first 2 keynote speakers of the 3, realized these are both women, which was very intentional. And then I was looking for recommendations for another speaker. And so I said, you know, got this list of people that we could maybe pick from. And I picked a couple of people that like I was, you know, fans of, or friends of mine who I really thought a lot of because maybe they helped me in technology kind of get my start. And so when we had the opportunity and I realized like this could send a really powerful message to have like 3 women keynote speaking. And so it was partially by design and partially just kind of happenstance, I guess. And once that happened, then I think it started sending kind of a message that this is a little different than your average tech conference. We're going to prioritize something very different. And I think it's like the Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and I'll get the quote wrong, but it was like, how many, I think somebody asked, I should probably like look this up. It's like, how many women is enough to have on the Supreme Court? And I think she basically said all.
Yeah.
Like, it would not be a problem because there have been all men for do this thing for
years.
So long.
Yeah.
So, you know, we didn't have any rules that like XYZ needs to be all men or women or people of color. What we did do is kind of look at what we've done in the past and notice and then decide that we need to kind of change the way maybe talks are picked. So let's make it a community model. Let's go to a blind, you know, type process. Then let's go to a double blind process. That way, you know, when you start taking out speaker names and you start removing the bios from, you know, proposals, it really changes the people at the top. So you don't always get the same people all the time. And so we do have some people who are very spectacular. And even though it's double blind, even though they don't put their bios in, they're always going to be the top 10 as far as reviews go, because they're really good at what they do, I guess. So I think changing that emphasis was a little better. And then from there, we kind of learned from mistakes, like, you know, because we had that first year where we had three women, it was a very valid criticism that we had three white women. And so we should, you know, we have a lot of underrepresented people in our community. We can do a better job. And we've just kind of iterated on it over the years.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is iteration, isn't it? It doesn't, you know, it's going from here to there, not, we're terrible, let's give up.
And I think as far as like some of the people who are doing amazing things in tech, you know, like I talked about Jesse Frizzell earlier, like, if I get my pick of who I want to speak at a conference, then why would I not ask Jesse Frizzell to be a keynote speaker? And she's not this year, by the way. But, you know, there are people that are just doing such amazing things that the people who I started following on Twitter definitely changed a lot. And so every year when we ask for keynote speakers, we just look at who we have. And like this year, I don't pick them. I haven't picked them in a few years, but I'll give recommendations on, you know, maybe people that I think would be good. And we do get a lot of white men still, but it just kind of comes down to who's going to give the right talk at the right time. And you mentioned async earlier, like how cool would it be to have a Python async kind of keynote for this year? So maybe that happens.
Yeah. Well, so as we come to the close of this interview, what else should we discuss? So you have, I know, a number of side projects. All three of us are, I guess, Jenga developers of a certain age with kids. What should we discuss that'd be interesting to people?
So I think, If I do one thing well, I think it's driven by the idea of the campsite rule, which is leave the campsite better than you found it. And I think that works for relationships. That works for community projects. I think it works for clients. And that's the one thing that I think that the more time that you spend making the campsite better, or, you know, putting effort into making the community better, I think people who also identify with that are also going to put their efforts into trying to do that. And so, if I had any like parting wisdom, it's follow the campsite rule. And then the kid stuff I think is great too, if you want to talk about that or
I don't know, whatever
you guys.
Let's talk about it. I mean, side note, we can edit it out if we don't like it, or we can include it. People tend to like that stuff.
Look, I mean, the thing for me with kids, it's just about energy levels and maintaining those and realizing that there has to be a rhythm to life, that if you don't maintain, it's unsustainable. And when you're young and you can perhaps have a lion on the weekend or whatever, you can maltreat yourself and somehow get away with it. But actually it has a cost, which perhaps you don't notice. But once you've got youngsters, because on the weekend they get up at exactly the same time as they do every night, there is no lion. There is no break. There is no day off. So if you don't care for yourself, you can't perform, and you can't perform as a parent. And you can't perform at work, and you can't keep going, not just this week or this month, but all year and all next year and for the next 20 years when they're going to need you. And so for me, that's this kind of lesson, professional lesson I learned as a parent, was about self-care and the priority of self-care. And it's much more important than some project deadline that's fake and all the rest of it. That would be where I would begin.
Well, I would say, I mean, to make an analogy too, it carries over into projects and coding. So all the things that you know you need to do, you know, stay up to date with Django, add tests, you just have enough experience where you go, I'm going to prioritize that over maybe this new feature or th- this rush deadline because you just know how it's going to play out and you've seen the record play. And, you know, again, hopefully this is wisdom. And, you know, it ultimately just makes you more, it does make you more efficient. I think maybe the challenge is that it can be hard to communicate that efficiency to someone else who doesn't have that knowledge. But it's certainly, I feel like every year I'm a better Django developer, and it has nothing to do with the number of hours I put in, but it has a lot to do with, to your point, Jeff, initially, of knowing what to say no about and having that framework for making decisions about, personal time and then also professional time.
I think I've learned that I'm not going to say yes to something that I can't put the energy in to do it. So I'm either going to be all in or I'm going to be all out. Like I don't like the middle on that. Maybe my kid has taught me that a little bit because my kid just does not care. My kid doesn't care if I have a deadline. You know, he's happy to come to my, you know, computer. He loves like Amazon Echoes and Alexas. So he will point and say bus. And that's really all he cares about is he wants to hear Will's on the bus. He just doesn't care about deadlines. And so there's just something about that I definitely, and I guess I'm the only person here with just a kid. You all have multiple kids, which is just, I don't even know how you do it.
Well, one at a time.
The energy stuff you're absolutely right about. And I think it's because my kid doesn't care if I'm tired. Yeah. Let's go outside. Let's do these things. And so that's kind of nice actually. But
yeah, it's a good slap across the face of perspective on a 24/7 basis, which
I think it's helped me too, because I know there's this idea of like flow, and you know, you're in flow, and you know, kids just, again, they don't care about flow. And so I've had to kind of learn that I need to be more concise. And if I do, like if he has taken a nap, maybe that's an hour, maybe that's 2 hours, but it definitely changes that I've got 2 hours, whether I'm going to do something around the house or laundry or whatever. I definitely approach it very differently. And to me, it's not an art what we do. It's a job. So I don't really worry about like writer's block or coding block or plumber's block. You know, I've got this amount of time. I'm either going to get this done or I'm not going to get this done. And so I kind of pick and choose what I'm going to work on if I have the luxury of working on something based on what I think I have available in that time. So I that's the one lesson about having a kid that was amazing for me, is that, you know, flow is just non-existent when you're a parent, I feel like.
Yeah. Well, you're just so deliberate and focused when you have the chance to be that you can't entertain thoughts of, I mean, it's sort of like sometimes you'll see people on YouTube with their morning routines and their evening routines, and, you know, people will fill the space that they have, but kids fill the space for you. So when you do have those gaps, you say, right, I can get a lot done in 20 minutes actually on this coding thing if I have to.
As well, like,
yeah, and it's just that.
Well, sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
As well, the thing, if you spend time with your kid, you're spending time with your kid, your right brain, your creative bit of your brain is busy working on the problem that you couldn't solve anyway. And you come back to the computer later on and you've got that 20 minutes, say, and it's like, yeah, there's a solution for you. And that was kind of free work in a way, because you didn't have to sit at the computer laboring for it. You were playing with your kid. And it's like, the life pays you back for being present. And it's like, thank you.
Well, I think maybe we could end on that one, Carlton. Well said.
Jeff, thank you. That's awesome. Thanks for coming on the show. And thank you all for listening, as ever. If you've got any questions, you can find us as Chat Django on Twitter. And we're at djangochat.com. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.